This is Edge Cases. I'm Andrew Pontius.
I'm Will French.
And our job... Sorry, that made me laugh for some reason. And our topic this week is, how would I learn Android?
Oh, good, yeah. Good.
So, and you know, the answer is I wouldn't, and that's it. Oh, great. Thanks for listening. Next time.
Shortest episode ever.
Yeah, right. I'm going to beat your episode. yeah. So this was started in part by a post by Justin Williams when he said he talked about ramping up on Android development. That was the name of the post. Have you read this post?
I'm behind on my feed, so I have not read it.
I mean, it's real short. It's got six steps that he recommends for people to use to learn Android. And I think I got to step two by the time I stopped for this recording. So, you know, we'll see how that translates.
I'm sure the other four steps weren't important at all.
Yeah, right. So he talks about why he's learning Android. And he says, so far I have found Android to be a fun diversion from iOS that will hopefully pay off in the long term as more people, read customers, start ramping up their Android plans. And so he's kind of, you know, seeing it as kind of a nice little jaunt and something that, and future, planning for the future. I would not have started Android development for those reasons myself. I'm not necessarily all that interested in just in trying a big new project for the sake of trying a big new project. I do like where I am now. I'm kind of at the height of my abilities, my experience for what I can do. I can do deep, complex work like that right now in my chosen field. You know, you can throw me at something and I know that I can make something really great and really powerful for you without having to, you know, thumb through a lot of books or look at a lot of videos or anything like that. Although it's also nice because I am still learning quite a bit about iOS as I go. So, and normally I would not really be looking at another platform right now. So I would think that if I'm going to do it, it would be less because, well, you know, it'll be fun. More like it's fear, really. So you see stories every day about Android market share increasing, and the number 80% has been bandied about quite a bit in various stories. Now, if you look, John Gruber of Daring Fireball has published more than one rebuttal for this sort of thing. He's got one post called The Church of Market Share from January of 2012, and then he's got one from this month, actually, called the same thing as a story from The Guardian by Charles Arthur, Why an 80% Market Share Might Only Represent Half of Smartphone Users. Wolf, did you see this?
I did not.
This is from the beginning of November, so it's been around a little while. What this guy says is because market share, you know, you might think when somebody says market share, you might think, well, that means installed base because that's market share, right? And it's generally not. It's generally how much is being sold in for any particular period. And so you might have, you know, their argument was, well, this 80% number you keep hearing about is current sales, but it isn't how many devices are actually out there and being used. So therefore... And then here's where it kind of goes off the rails. And they say, well, therefore, nothing. He kind of mostly just says in the article, well, you don't have enough information to say anything. You don't have enough information. Well, the trouble with arguing that, especially the way Gruber does, which is, well, that so that it seemed that Gruber's, if not his actual point, his insinuation is, well, so therefore we don't have to worry about it. And of course, that's not true. If you keep hearing about 80% market share, 80% market share, they're selling 80%, 4 out of 5 of every phone sold is an Android phone, then it doesn't matter what your market share is currently, and it doesn't matter how few phones are being sold for any one of those statistics, it will eventually add up. And you'll eventually have an installed base, which looks more like 80-20 or 80-10 or whatever it's going to be, than it does now, unless you start hearing stories about iPhone, you know, starting to sell 80% in its various markets. And you don't hear that. You don't hear that at all. And let's see. Oh, and then the other point that Gruber makes is that when nobody really uses their Android phones, that the majority of people who have Android phones are treating them as dumb phones. They aren't buying a lot of apps. They aren't spending a lot of money. They aren't spending a lot of time on the internet. Apple has also made this point. But the thing is, 80%, I mean, 80% is a lot. It's a really high percentage. So eventually, even if only a small percentage of Android users are using their phones the way iPhone users are using their phones, they will still eventually overwhelm absolute number of people on the iPhone who are using their phone that way. And, you know, you see, let's see, that Google Play is now has more downloads than the iOS App Store. It's funny, there were so many keynotes.
Oh, I missed that. Okay.
There were so many keynotes where Apple was touting, oh, we have so many more downloads than anybody else. Well, they didn't do that in the latest in the latest one. I think they might have just talked about revenue this time. And I think for a couple of times they've talked about internet usage as opposed to absolute numbers, because originally they talked absolute numbers as well. And, you know, they keep stopping, they keep removing, you know, the indicators that are against them one by one as they as more and more of them go against them.
But will they ever put like Photoshop on an Android and iOS and then click the start button at the same time?
Oh, what?
This was a standard like horse race that they would do with when they released the latest Macs, is that they would put Photoshop on the PC.
Oh, right.
PC, yep. And for that 1 week where the Mac was ahead, they would.
Sure, I doubt they would do that quite that way. But the thing here is, you know, if you said, well, Apple's doing everything they can and they're just not making it work, I don't know, I might feel a little differently, but it does feel, especially over the last year or two, that Apple is not fighting back in the way that we would want them to as developers. You know, the iPad mini was $329 instead of $199. And that was, you know, a lot of people were concerned about that, were disappointed in that. The iPhone 5C, which was another time when people were saying, well, Apple is finally going to get into a lower cost phone. Well, no, it's still, what, $500-$600 unlocked instead of $200 unlocked, something like that. And so each time these things happen, certain Apple partisans will say, oh, it doesn't matter. It makes total sense. Apple's being smart by not diluting their brand. Apple's doing all these cool things. But, you know, it seems to me that right now is the time to go lower cost. Because we did see this with the iPod, that Apple could sell devices with a lot of quality to them for a lower price because they were selling so many more of them. And that's really where Apple's at right now. Apple's selling a lot of iPhones. You keep hearing about, oh, they can't do this, they can't do that, because they're selling, they have so many iPhones to sell that they can't be more adventurous with their hardware the way other companies can be. So you would think that now would be the time for them to say, well, you know, we can get really good prices on virtually everything. So now would be the time to try to squeeze things down and make the best of it. But they're not. And they've had a couple of chances to do it, and they're just not. And again, you might say, well, you know, Apple will just be a BMW instead of a Ford or whatever. But for our developers, for us as developers, it really has a huge impact. Because if things keep going the way they're going to go, we will, you know, we'll be back to the Mac, and not in a good way. You know, we'll be at a point where we're at 5% market share again, or install base, you know, 5 to 10% install base. And at some point, all of these companies that right now are saying, okay, we'll do our iOS version first, we'll start saying, well, we're going to do our Android version first. And, you know, Apple will just keep slipping further and further behind. So, and Apple itself will be okay. They won't be great, but they'll be okay because they're still selling a lot of phones comparatively, and they're still doing, you know, they're still making money, but developers will have a much tougher time. So, you know, it feels a bit to me like Apple's kind of letting us down. And if Apple's not going to look out for us, then there's less of a reason for us to look out for Apple, less of a reason for us to stay monogamous. Is that the right word?
That's an interesting turn of phrase. I think it applies, but it gives me unsettling connotations.
Yes, it does. Well, that's our title, Unsettling Connotations, the edge cases story. Okay, so now that we've heard me babble a little bit about why I want to do it, let's go through some of Justin's steps. And his first step is to buy a Nexus 5. And I'm not going to do that. You know, I didn't do that for this episode. I'm not going to do it immediately. But what was interesting about that was, you know, he says, you know, you shouldn't just use the emulator or the simulator or whatever. You know, you should really, you have an actual device in your hand. And that's true. I would agree with that. What's interesting here is for the iPhone, Gruber has also talked about how for developers and for other users, the iPod Touch has been a great resource that, that the Android ecosystem has not been able to match, because it gives you a, you know, the device with the OS on it for a lot less money than a phone. But I was looking at it, you know, the Nexus 5, which is unlocked, is $349 for this, you know, the cheapest version. So I got 16 gigs of RAM, something like that. And, you know, the iPod Touches these days start at $299, at least the newest ones. And so what's that? That's a $50 difference? That's not that's nothing, right?
Yeah.
And then I also looked, well, could I get one even cheaper than that on eBay? You know, something that's even cheaper than an iPod Touch. And you can't, because when you look on eBay, they're all more than $349.
Yeah, I've seen that on eBay a few times. I don't understand the dynamics there, where you pay more for a used thing.
Well, most of the ones where they're advertising it are actually advertising ones that haven't been opened.
Okay, but still, it doesn't make any sense.
Well, it would make sense if
it's... the eBay transaction when I could get buy direct from Google for that amount.
I would assume that must indicate some amount of supply constraint. That it might take, you know, weeks or months to get your Nexus 5. But
okay.
I haven't tried it, and I would have to think a little further before I try it. But that's what I would think. Okay, and the second one is the Android programming guide from Big Nerd Ranch. Where is that? And I didn't do that at first when I was doing it, because I thought, hey, you know, heck, I'm just going to download the SDK myself and try it out, which I did. And one thing I noticed with that is that the SDK is, of course, it's free. Most SDKs are generally free, but there's also no sign-up required. You know, unlike Apple, which requires you to make an account with them and do all this stuff, you can just download the SDK directly from Google with no problem. And that's going to be a recurring theme, that Google does not a bottleneck. Does not a bottleneck is the wrong word. They don't restrict access the way Apple does, and a lot of their things. So when I open up the SDK, what application do I find in there?
Well, I imagine it would be Eclipse.
It would be Eclipse. Now Eclipse, there's been a post going there, not a post, a tweet, and I didn't find it before the show. I'll try to find it, but people retweet it every so often. And actually, maybe more than one person has tweeted it. Who knows? But it's a tweet from someone who says, "Oh my God, I used Eclipse today, and I will never say another bad thing about Xcode ever again." Now, of course, if I made that promise, I would run out of things to talk about on this show within a couple of weeks. So I'm not going to make that promise. But Eclipse makes me shudder. It's ugly. It feels very Windows-like. Have you used it, Wolf?
I've used it extensively with my WebOps background. WebOps being ported to Java and Java development. There was this extension to Eclipse called Wolips that you can, which is a terrible name, but
it really is.
But it's a fine set of extensions. It's funny with Eclipse because I remember, like, I think this was back in the Project Builder days. And PBX days, I should say. Yep. And I remember like showing it to the members of my local or meetup, showing them Eclipse and the things it could do. And they were like, their jaws dropped because they're like, oh my God, like look at how much better this thing is than stupid old PBX. And man, that tide has turned.
Well, and certainly, you know, you could argue that Xcode 3 was not really all that much prettier than Eclipse. And yes, it was definitely not getting the same kind of attention and love in some ways. And it was also, you know, Eclipse is almost entirely made up of plugins. It's got a public plugin architecture, which we have complained about, that Xcode does not have that. So it's got a lot of things going for it. And you know, this is why a lot of companies will use it as their IDE instead of making their own, because it's just so easy to throw stuff into Eclipse and customize it the way you want. Although it is a little weird for me at this point to think of a company, you know, like Google saying, well, we're just not going to make our own IDE, you know, because I guess I've been with Apple long enough. I've drunk the Kool-Aid enough that, my God, you have an IDE that's not under your control. How could you do that? Well, but a lot of people do that. So it was interesting coming back to it. And I don't think I've used Eclipse professionally, but I have played around with it a decent amount when I was looking at refactoring features of competing IDEs. When I was at Apple. So yeah, it's pretty much as un-Mac-like as I remember. But it is functional, certainly. So let's see.
And in many ways, Xcode 4 UI almost feels inspired by Eclipse.
Well, maybe in the things that it can do, but well, and this also actually it brings up a good point. I mean, having used Xcode as much as I have, I tend to think of Xcode's look and feel at this point as being Mac-like, but it really isn't, because there's nothing. You could never have an IDE which is totally conforming to the platform, because IDEs need to do so many custom things that no platform has native patterns for.
Oh yeah, like give me an example on Xcode 3.
The way projects work, mm-hmm. In that most platforms have a document model mm-hmm. of some sort. Mm-hmm. But projects are a document model, which is a two-level model. So you have to be able to handle a project, and then you have to be able to handle the documents inside of a project. But you need to be able to handle maybe having two projects open at once, and you know the whole how do you handle the window model,
okay. You know,
and you know, so that's something that you can't really expect an IDE to say, well, I just do exactly what the platform says I'm going to do.
Right? Didn't that also kind of boil down to like? Adding recent files to Xcode 3 like took a really long time.
And it's gone. I think it's gone from Xcode 4 again, isn't it?
I don't even know. But I know that like the as you say, the naive use of the document model on say Xcode 3 is that the recent documents there would actually be your project files, when it's not the files, project files you actually want to access recently. You want to access the source files recently.
Right. So that's it. In order to make it act like the platform would normally act, you actually have to implement things differently. So, mm-hmm. Anyway. So let's see. There were some interesting things. I was looking, you know, things I'll talk about a little bit with today. The resource files. So like in Xcode resource files, you know, you've got zip files and storyboard files. In Android, resource files are straight XML. You know, they're .xml files. And it's easy to and seems to be almost encouraged that you edit them as XML, which is a little weird. But there are custom editors as well, so it's like Interface Builder. They have their version of Interface Builder.
When you say edit as XML, do you mean textually, or do they have some sort of like
PLS editor?
Okay,
textually. So, and actually, I'm getting a little ahead of myself, but the Big Nerd Ranch guide. Actually encourages you to use the textual editing at first mm-hmm. instead of okay. going through the UI. Okay, I'll get a little bit more into that in a second. And it's, you know, it's Java source code files. It's also Java, pre-generated files as well. But I guess, so the next thing on my list anyway, we'll get to all that in a little bit, is, you know, I just opened up a sample project and ran it. When I first got started, and the simulator, Justin talks about the simulator a bit in his post. He talks about how it's painful to use, which is one reason why you should get your Android phone. And what I found in the simulator was it took minutes at like 95% CPU for it to even open. For it to even run. And I guess I'm calling it a simulator. I would have to go back to find out whether they actually call it a simulator. Actually,
I thought they call it emulator.
Call it an emulator, right? So
that's one of the reasons it's slow, right?
That would be one reason it would be slow, because they're actually emulating everything about it instead of, as Apple does, using what's basically the Mac runtime behind the scenes for most of it and just translating what's needed into iOS stuff. So yeah, it's slow. It hangs a lot. It doesn't hang, but it doesn't. I can't connect to it. It's very difficult to connect to it. So I can imagine actually having a device might be easier. But I also found, you know, I actually found myself going to Stack Overflow quite a bit right from the beginning of my development. And there were a few tweaks that seemed to make it a little better. But you still, you know, there's a lot of quitting and restarting and a lot of doing other things that made it difficult, more difficult than the iOS simulator. And, you know, for example, I couldn't figure out how to kill my app. You know, on the simulator, you know, there's a big red button right there. You know, you just built it and ran it. And you kill mm-hmm. it right there. And you've got to actually, you know, bring up this other tab and find your process and kill it from in there. Mm-hmm. And so that made me feel a little weird. And so, you know, there were enough of these little issues that came up that I realized, no, it's time to get the book. So I got the book, the Big Nerd Ranch book. Let's see. What is it called?
So you actually took one for the team, and actually you've won. For a guy who's proclaimed disinterest in doing all this, you've won pretty far on that road.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, when I first started putting together, you know, looking into this for this episode, I was probably less hardcore than after, you know, all that stuff I was just talking about at the beginning made me think, well, you know, not doing this, if I don't even do anything for this, I'm really kind of putting my head in the sand. Okay. And I think more of that now, not because just this episode, not because I think I've changed my thinking, but just because, again, I'm thinking it through more now, because I knew all this stuff in the past, but now it really hits home that, you know, it's really going to happen. It's really going to happen that Android development is going to be more lucrative than iOS development at some point. I think that's inevitable. And I think it's good to have some sense of it. Okay. So the Big Nerd Ranch book is just called Android Programming, the Big Nerd Ranch Guide. So that'll be in the show notes. $23 on Amazon. And what I did with iOS when I started iOS is I bought the iPhone SDK. I bought iPhone SDK development. That's the name of the book, written by Bill Dudney and Chris Adamson. This is from 2009, and I think I must have gotten it from someone else's recommendation on Twitter. And how did I use that book? Well, I read about a third of it, and then I stopped. And that's actually all you need, because what I really needed, what I need here, as you can see from just the little stuff that I was just talking about, what I will need in general is something to get me over that hump of, oh my God, I don't understand how any of this works. I'm having problems at every you know, turn. I can't get a damn thing to work. Okay, I just need somebody to run me through all those steps. And, you know, would you read the intro to this book? It's what they say, too. They say, yeah, this is really here to get you over the hump. Okay, great. So I'll do that. Interesting that one of the sample apps is that they talk about, and I didn't actually get to do it. I didn't even get through the first sample app, but is a Flickr app. Because I've actually had this test for people at my last company that I was giving an interview for to see if they could do iOS development for us. Like if you just say, okay, make me a table that gets content from a service like Flickr or Twitter, and then downloads your thumbnails for your table. That, I mean, it should be pretty simple, right? But it turns out that really stumps a lot of people who don't know how tables work on iOS, because the cells are reused. So if you say, well, I'll just throw out all these processes to get the thumbnail, you know, you're in trouble, because they're going to return for a cell that's now being used for something else. And so, you know, it's just sort of funny that they, I would bet there's a similar interesting gotchas with the Flickr app, and that's probably why they put it in there. Another interesting thing they said at the beginning of the book was that they are targeting older versions of the Android OS. They are targeting 2.2 and 2.3, which is Froyo and Gingerbread. Whereas the latest one is 4.4. And you might think, well, that's only two versions away. But as you could see, like Froyo and Gingerbread were each considered, I believe, major versions. Honeycomb was considered a major version. And they don't just do like 1, 2, 3, 4. Like Froyo is 2.2, Gingerbread is 2.3. Honeycomb is 3.1 and 3.2. Ice Cream Sandwich was 4.0 versus Jelly Bean, which was 4.1. Yeah. So you can't really tell when it's a major release or not, you know, by that. And then the latest one is KitKat. So the latest one is 4.4. So there's been 4 releases since Gingerbread. But, you know, they say, well, most people are still running 2.3. So if you want to learn how to program in the real world, you probably want to target these older versions.
Man, I thought the Big Cat names were bad, but
I know.
I complained about this on Twitter before, and, you know, one thing I need to say to compliment Google for, even though all the names are just terribly stupid, is that at least they're in alphabetical order. I don't know if you've noticed that.
I did not. I even have them listed here, and I did not notice that.
Yeah, neither did I. And it's, I forget who informed me about this, but yeah, that helps. It's still intensely stupid, but at least that helps.
So they're up to K, so they've got quite a few letters left in the alphabet. Mm-hmm. So when I was looking through the sample application in the book, it was interesting because there's a lot of terminology that I didn't know that's just different but analogous. Like I think there's an activity class, and they say it manages user activity with a screen of information. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, that sounds like a view controller. Mm-hmm. Right? Okay, there's a layout file. Well, that sounds like, you know, a Zib or a storyboard. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you got to get terminology down, but it's all, you know, it's analogous. It's not, you know, I don't think, oh my God, this is entirely different paradigms. Mm-hmm.
I would imagine it's probably something like intents is really something that iOS doesn't have.
Having gotten there.
Okay.
maybe for my third or fourth episode about learning Android.
Great.
But it's interesting because the file formats, the resource file formats seem pretty rudimentary compared to the iOS ones. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, but I also think it's understandable. Nibs and Zibs have existed for what, decades? Mm-hmm. Basically, well, nibs anyway.
Yeah.
But all this on Android is pretty new, so they're kind of building it from scratch, and they haven't had the time to sort of evolve to do more complex things. So I do wonder whether that lack of complexity, that lack of the ability to do more complex things, frustrates Android developers. The way I think it would frustrate.
And there's also like a software mm-hmm. tooling issue where if you kind of start with the idea that you're hand editing XML, you tend to build data structures that yep. fit that well. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you view XML as purely an object persistence mechanism, you tend to view it, you know, do things like Xcode's project format does, where you just like you spit out this pretty flat tree that has like element mm-hmm. IDs to other elements. Type stuff, and yep. yeah,
no, it's interesting. They call the deserializing of the objects from the XML files inflating, which you know, it makes it clear that they don't think of it as serialization deserialization the way Apple did when they were first doing it. Because of course these nib files were originally just the Cocoa deserialization APIs.
Right, the NS coding stuff, yeah. Even the old school NS coding stuff, yeah.
Now, which just makes it more all the more wonderful that Apple has turned away from that in the latest version and given us something which is more human readable. I did a post recently, which I also I don't remember what the name of it is anymore. I'll put it in the show notes, where I talk about, you know, how wonderfully, pleasantly surprising the storyboard and Zib formats.
Right.
Have been for me because they are human readable. Mm-hmm. All of the benefits you get from that. Mm-hmm. So anyway, but I should keep talking about Android. So there were a bunch of things that I had to look up in Stack Overflow because they weren't working for me. There's something called an r.java file, which is part of their resource setup, and it's an actual class called R, uppercase R.
Okay.
Which has inner classes with names like ID, layout, and menu, and those are all lowercase. And then inside that are class variables that are the constants you need to use for your resources. So if you need an ID for one of your buttons, mm-hmm. you would reference that by saying r.id.my_button. Because my underscore button is a class variable on the class ID, which you know is set equal to whatever the number is.
And that's application-wide?
It's application-wide.
Okay.
So it's interesting. I mean, I knew that there was more generated code here, and I think also Windows does that too. They generate classes. They generate code, whereas Apple generally tends to have resources that are read in, right? It's, mm-hmm. it's kind of a different philosophical bent. And, you know, I could say, oh, my God, it's so much worse that they generate code, but I'm sure I would get used to it.
Yeah, it's speaking as, you know, Mr. Mode Generator, I'm actually anti-generated code, but that's pretty much because of my Lisp background.
Sure, but I think some of it will depend on, well, I think some of it is this sense that if you generate a class and then you have to hand edit it such that you can't round trip anymore.
Right.
And my impression here is that, no, this is, you know, this is basically just a plus file, you know, because you don't, mm-hmm. you'll never be hand editing this. And in fact, there's one part where you actually have to add something to your other XML file to make your r.java file add something to it. You're like requesting that the r.java file adds a new entry to itself. It's a little weird, but at least it means, you know, that you're not hand editing it yourself. So that's good. But that's as far as I got. I didn't actually get that far.
Okay.
And there were actually a bunch of, you know, even just to get that far, because I was reading through the Big Nerd Ranch book, and, you know, they don't mention a lot of these problems that I was having. And maybe I just, you know, maybe if there was a little troubleshooting bit at the end that I haven't gotten to, that they might have mentioned some of them. But there were at least three major problems that stopped me dead until I asked on Stack Overflow, not asked, but until I searched on Stack Overflow. And one was that the r.java file actually disappeared on me.
That sounds important.
Yeah, I was like, wait a minute, I need that. And I still don't know why, because I ran out of time. But it turns out that because you're generating the r.java file in an ongoing fashion, you don't do it when you click build in general. It just does it automatically for you. Whenever you edit these other XML files, if you screw something up in those XML files, then the r.java file disappears.
Ah.
Whoops. And it doesn't come back when you undo that changes. So I was still figuring that out. And you might say, oh my God, that's so horrible. You know, I'll never do Android. No, this sort of thing happens all the time with all developer tools. You know, you get yourself into these positions where, hey, how did that happen? Hey, nobody's helping me with that. I better go off to the internet and find out, you know, everyone else has had this problem. It totally happens. So uh-huh. I don't hold it against them. Like, you know, if I got a real level of expertise here, and I saw that there were easy things or even just some things that they could do to make this get fixed, and they didn't fix it for years and years, that might be one thing. But right now, I'm just going to roll with it and be glad that Stack Overflow exists, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, that's pretty much as far as I got. But I did get a certain way in, and I think that if I kept reading the book, I'd make good progress. Again, the big thing being that with the emulator being so slow and so finicky, it might actually be worth my time to get a device.
I knew it was slow. How is it? What do you mean by finicky?
It takes like 3 minutes for the device to come up, uh-huh. And then you say, okay, run, and sometimes it runs and sometimes it doesn't.
Gotcha.
Most of the time it doesn't, and you know you can't just kill this. Emulator and bring it back up real quickly the way you can with the simulator, because you know, mm-hmm. you got 3 minutes to wait until it comes up again. And I'm sure that I would get more familiar with it and figure out more ways to make it work more reliably. I hope so, if I were doing this a lot, but it's quite a time sink right now. Now there's another emulator, I have it in my notes here, Genemotion.
Okay.
Which also is a fairly horrible name for something. And I actually did start to download it, I think. And you can get like the plugins for Eclipse. You can get by pointing. There's one spot in Eclipse where you could say, you know, go get this plugin for me by giving it a mm-hmm. URL.
Right.
Which is, again, very non-Apple-y way to do right. things. But I did that, and I think I downloaded the Genemotion emulator, but I haven't run it yet. And I would also probably try that if I were to keep going with this to see if mm-hmm. that would be any faster, any better.
Okay.
So ongoing. In terms of the rest of Justin's steps, I'm not going to go over all of them because I didn't have time to do them anyway, but I'm going to mention two of them. One thing he says is watch a lot of Dev Bytes on YouTube, and Dev Bytes is the name of their video series.
Okay. Whose video series? That Google's?
Google's.
Okay.
So Google puts a whole bunch of videos, like 10 to 20 to 30
minutes.
Oh, my
God. You could, like, bookmark these videos? And they're accessible by the public? Oh, my God.
That's pretty much what Justin has to say. Yeah, he says, you know, it's just so wonderful that they're completely public. And, well, not even that. Actually, so he makes that point about the Google I.O. sessions later, so we'll talk about that now, that, you know, Apple will only give you their WWDC sessions behind their own, in their own website, you know, after logging in.
It is a paywall, effectively.
It is a paywall. That's mm-hmm. true. That's true. Well, can you get to them with just a dev account where you don't?
I know they had free dev accounts for a while, and then I heard that they didn't.
Yep.
And yeah, I don't even know anymore.
But yeah, the big problem is that, you know, without being able to have this on things like YouTube, you can't have links to them. I mean, you know, we've tried to have links to things, and they screwed up.
Mm-hmm.
So that was his point about the Google I/O sessions. But the thing about DevBytes is that these are additional videos that are not just from a conference. These are things they do on an ongoing basis to give you a little bit more information, to get little bits of more information about how to develop.
Nice.
And I just watched one. It's interesting, you know, they'll in the same way they do for conferences, they, you know, they've got the people who actually work on it mm-hmm. talking.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that strikes me that, you know, this is a lot more work for developers, but it also means that they're probably not going to be anywhere near as polished as they would be at a conference. Mm-hmm. And I could even see that with the one video that I saw. It's got a lot of nifty graphics, but the speaking was a bit rough in mm-hmm. points, you know, because it was obvious that he hadn't, you know, he hadn't really polished it mm-hmm. down to a, you know, to a shine with that, because he's probably, you know, he's got to do his own work and he's got to do these mm-hmm. things as well. But still, it's more information than Apple gives. So it's interesting. It's an interesting way of looking at it, of communicating with your developers. So, and that's pretty much the details of it. But I wanted to talk a little about my conclusions of it, mm-hmm. of the process. Because, you know, my question was, well, how would I learn Android? And really, you know, having gone through these bits that I've done so far, I would learn it the way I learned iOS, you know, with buying a book, with, you know, going through all the resources there, with basically, you know, treating it the same way that I treated iOS. I didn't see anything in what I've done so far, which makes it sound like it would be incredibly different. But it was interesting because, you know, I have gotten up to speed on iOS pretty quickly. But I think that's in part because, you know, I had 8 years of Mac development before that.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And there isn't anything like that with Android. If I were, you know, I could work at Apple and work on an app at Apple, a giant app at Apple, mm-hmm. and still be learning, you know, Cocoa.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if I were to work on Android, I'd have to only work on Android. I couldn't work on, you know, other Google projects and still be learning Android. And of course, I wouldn't want to go to Google at this point. And anyway, I'm kind of done with big companies at this point. So while I could learn it the way I learned iOS, I couldn't really replicate that exactly. And would that be a problem? Well, I'd have to see. I do have also experience learning other platforms besides Apple. It's been a while, but I have. And that also felt a little comfortable. It felt comfortable to be getting back to Java. It felt comfortable to be getting back to something like Eclipse. So it may be that it would all kind of be a wash in the end, that I could still learn it pretty quickly and still do things pretty quickly there. And it's just a question of whether I want to. But because I've spent so much time on Apple's platforms, moving to Android would really be like immigrating, really. You know, like Android is like moving to France. You're no longer in your native country. You know, like Eclipse would mean giving up on basically the native Mac look and feel forever for my work development, mm-hmm. if I were going to do that. Now, you know, we've talked a little bit about how IDEs are not quite native anyway, but, you know, Eclipse does go way beyond that.
I do know there was a project called Maclips that tried to...
these names! My God.
That tried to use more, like, standard HI widgets for that. But, of course, that was even Carbon, so, that, you know, how well it supports that. But maybe they were using something else. But it probably is at least worth a Google. But, yeah, your point stands.
Yeah. And the thing is, but that's the thing. Like, you move to this other country because you want to do things in the way they do at this other country. You want to get those advantages. You know, saying, well, sure, we'll use Eclipse, but we'll use an Eclipse that we have to keep updating ourselves to make all the changes that we get from other vendors work with our custom shell.
Yeah.
You know, no, that's just not going to, you know, you move to France to learn French, to speak French. and that's the thing, like, I'm going to beat this thing to death here, but you know, the benefit, you know, what are the benefits you'd have in France, right? You would have, you know, universal healthcare. You have, you know, stronger unions,
croissants,
giving my croissants, you know, better wine, everything else. You know, you move there to get those advantages. You wouldn't want to move there and just have, you know, Big Macs all the time. And there's a lot of advantages, you know, as you said, Android is, as I said, not you said, I'll let you talk in a minute. you know, there are a lot of advantages to working on Android. You get a bigger market share. You get Google's help in their way. You could work at Java. You know, there's still a lot of resistance to Objective-C, I think, in the developer world. You can probably use more third-party libraries than you can on iOS, although iOS is actually pretty good these days. So, if I were to do it, I would probably, for the time that I was in Android, I would do it whole hog. I wouldn't try to make it look more like iOS or Mac for me. And that's actually, you know, and again, I pretty much was saying it before, but the thing that would be problematic is not just learning it. Like, I think I could get to that point where, remember I was talking when you're learning a new code base, where I said, you know, you have to start with fixing bugs and then working on smaller features, or actually, I don't remember exactly what the list was. Go read the, look at the, whatever. But, you know, I could get to fixing bugs pretty easily, but actually I would still, I'm still looking for that way to learn the idioms of it the way I did at Apple with Cocoa. Mm-hmm. And that may be, you know, just working on a larger team, working on an Android project. And that is certainly possible these days if I wanted to go that route. Mm. So we shall see.
Yeah.
So your thoughts?
Well, yeah. So it's not surprised that Justin is kind of checking out the Android thing. I believe he also checked out other platforms as well. The Windows Phone. I believe he checked out Windows Phone, and I think he looked at WebOS too. And which was Palm's
right.
kind of operating system for the phone. And let me tell you, it's like WebOS will spoil you. It will, like iOS 7's multitasking, it feels like a really terrible ripoff of it. And
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Nope, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, it's the, how they, like, it would, they did a really effective job of like, it's kind of hard to explain, but it was like each screen was a card, and each app was like a set of cards. And they did a really good job of like interweaving. I think that like Android's intents kind of do this type of stuff. Whereas like I could be in like using the Yelp app and then bring up a web view to look at say a menu and then maybe a maps view. And those would show up as three cards, but still be inside the Yelp app.
Yeah.
While I mm-hmm. could switch. And when you would go in the multitasking view where you could look at your cards, it was very apparent what was going on. And iOS 7, man, just like it's terrible latency in terms of like they do a really bad job of like it's like snapping the pixels of the screen like as it existed like a minute ago or something. And so when you're like switching across apps, the views are outdated.
Yes, and, I've noticed
and
that
then
as well.
When you swap in, then it's like there's this horrendous pause where it takes like, I don't know, it feels like 5 seconds before the app is actually responsive. It pretends to be responsive right away, of course, but then it's like tap and you're now. I'm like, okay, this thing is just pretending to be active. It's the same pixels, but it actually is restoring or whatever. And also it does a terrible job that's like dropping apps all the time. Well, actually, it does remind me of WebOS, where this terminates apps that you're actually using. But, you know, WebOS was kind of doomed by bad hardware that they couldn't really keep up. And this is when you talk about like the Apple advantage of having mass economies of scale and all that Apple definitely had the advantage there in terms of better screens, better processors, more RAM, blah, 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 blah. So I guess.
Well, the other thing about Palm, though, I don't know if you saw, there was an article, a fairly long article, and it wasn't that long ago, where some insiders finally talked about what was really going on at Palm.
Yeah.
And what was interesting to me was, you know, Palm had a pretty good reputation for WebOS. Mm-hmm. And this article made it seem like, well, WebOS was almost kind of a fluke because it was just like two guys working on this side project that management kind of swooped in and said, oh my God, we'll use that. That looks much better than what we're actually working on. And, you know, some of that dysfunction of, you know, not having the whole company working on it right away and mm-hmm. having resentments and it being too slow because it was really just two guys who came up with it to begin with. Mm-hmm. That actually made me, you know, a little less sort of sad about WebOS not really making it, because it made it sound like even though we felt it had a lot of promise from the outside, it was actually a little more flawed coming together than we had known at the time. Mm-hmm. So when you said, oh, it was slow because of slow hardware, well, yes, but also maybe even just the software concept was too slow.
Sure.
They just, you know, they shouldn't have done it because they could never have gotten web, you know, the HTML stuff behind the scenes working all that well.
Yeah. The other thing is that, yeah, you mentioned that market share stuff, and it definitely feels, I mean, this is very anecdotal, but it definitely feels to me like all my friends 3 years ago had iPhones, and it seems like all my friends now have Androids, like normals.
Really?
Well. Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, other than my, like, Apple developer friends, all my normal friends seem to now have Androids.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so many of my friends are Apple developers that, you know, Apple platform developers, not Apple employees, that it's still a lot of iPhones for me. But yeah, no, that's very telling.
Yeah. And that does it for me.
All right. So we'll see you next time.